Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the Stern Galactic Experiment, how a bad cigar helped reorient atomic physics. This is Physics Today from some time ago, from 1st of December 2003, so that would have been some sort of anniversary of a year anniversary, as would expect, of the Stern Galactic Experiment. The history of the Stern Galactic Experiment reveals how persistence, accident, and luck can sometimes combine in just the right way. Belstav Friedrich recently moved from Harvard University to become senior scientist at the Fritz Haber Institute of Max Planck Society in Berlin. Dudley Herzbach is a professor of chemistry department and chemical biology at Harvard. Physics Today. The demonstration of space quantization carried out in Frankfurt, Germany in 1922 by Otto Stern and Walter Galact ranks among the dozen or so canonical experiments that ushered in the heroic age of quantum physics. Perhaps no other experiment is so often cited or elegantly conceptual simplicity. From it emerged both new intellectual vistas and a host of useful applications in quantum science. Yet even amongst atomic physicists, very few today are aware of the historical particulars that enhance the drama of the story and the abiding lessons it offers. Among the particulars are a warm bed, a bad cigar, a timely postcard, a railroad strike, and an uncanny conspiracy of nature that rewarded Stern and Galact. Their success in splitting a beam of silver atoms by means of magnetic fields startled, elated, and confounded pioneer quantum theorists, including several who beforehand had regarded an attempt to observe space quantization as naive and foolish. Descendants of the Stern Galactic Experiment, SGE, and its key concept in sorting quantum states via space quantization are legion. Among them are the prototypes for nuclear magnetic resonance, optical pumping, the laser, atomic clocks, as well as incisive discoveries such as the Lamb shift and anomalous increments in magnetic moments of the electron, which launched the quantum electrodynamics. That's interesting, I don't understand that. The means to probe nuclei, proteins, galaxies, image bodies, brains, perform eye surgery, read music or data from compact discs and scan barcodes on grocery packages or DNA base pairs in the human genome all stem from exploiting transitions between space quantized quantum states. Wow, I don't understand that. A new Centre for Experimental Physics in the University of Frankfurt had recently named in honour of Stern and Galact Seefiger 1. The opportunity to take part in the dedication prompted us to reenact the cigar story, as told by one of us, Hans Sachs, by Stern himself more than 40 years ago. We briefly trace the incident trajectory of Stern and Galact and the perplexing physics of the time which brought them to collaborate in Frankfurt. We also describe the vicissitudes and the receptions of the SGE before and after discovery of electron spin and report how the cigar smoke led to a Back to the Future deposition detector. Mindful of the memorial plaque in Frankfurt depicting Stern and Galact opposite sides of their split molecular beam, we also invite readers to reflect on later trajectories of the two fine scientists impelled in opposite trajectories by the tragic rise in power of Adolf Hitler. So this week for one, from osmotic soda to atomic beams. Otto Stern received his doctorate in the physical chemistry at the University of Brussels in 1912. In his dissertation, he presented the theory and experiments on osmotic pressure of concentrated solutions of carbon dioxide in various solvents, just generalized soda water. His proud parents offered to support him for postdoctoral study anywhere he liked. Motivated by the spirit of adventure, Stern became the first pupil of Albert Einstein. Then in Prague, their discussions were held in a cafe which was attached to a brothel. Soon Einstein was recalled to Zurich. Stern accompanied him there and was appointed a privatdozent for physical chemistry. Under Einstein's influence, Stern became interested in light quantum. the nature of atoms, magnetism, statistical particle physics, however, Sturm was shocked by the iconoclastic atomic model of Niels Bohr. Shortly after it appeared in mid-1913, Stern and his... iconoclastic atomic model of Niels Bohr. Stern and his colleagues Max von Laue made an earnest vow: if this nonsense of Bohr should in the end prove to be right, we will kick physics. When Einstein moved to Berlin in 1914, Stern became providence for the theoretical physics in Frankfurt. World War I soon intervened, but even while serving the German army, Stern managed to do significant works, including a successful but persistent experiment, an attempt to separate by diffusion a suspected hydrogen isotope of mass 2. There you go. I have the same feeling that the Bohr atom is complete madness. After the war, Stern returned to Frankfurt and became assistant to Max Born in the Institute of Theoretical Physics. There began Stern's molecular beam odyssey. He had learned the rudimentary experiments of Louis Dornier of 1911, which demonstrated that molecular rays of sodium formed by the effusion into a vacuum travel in straight lines. Stern was captivated by the simplicity and directness of the method, which enables us to make measurements on isolated neutral atoms or molecules with macroscopic tools, and thereby especially valuable for testing and demonstrating directly fundamental assumptions of theory. Born strongly... I think Born is one person I really hate. Born strongly encouraged Stern to pursue molecular beam experiments. Indeed, in 1919, Born himself undertook with his students Elizabeth Bormann to measure the mean free path for a beam of sulfur atoms attenuated by air. In Stern's first beam experiments, reported in 1920, and motivated by kinetic theory, he determined the mean thermal velocity of sulfur atoms in a clever way. He mounted the atomic beam source on a rotating platform, a miniature merry-go-round, and spun it at a modest fluid velocity, only 15 meters per second. That produced a small centrifugal displacement of the beam, indicative of the velocity distribution at the image by faint deposits of silver. From the shift of the deposits caused by reversing the direction of rotation, Stern was able to evaluate the far higher mean velocity of atoms, about 660 meters per second at 1,000 degrees. Soon after, his design for the SGE would invoke an analogue of the test of the Bohr model. A magnetic field gradient should produce the opposite deflection of the beam atoms according to the planetary electron rotates clockwise or anticlockwise about the fixed axis. Oh, there you go. Well, so this is, he was trying to disprove the Bohr atom, is that right? I was trying to... his design for the SDE would invoke an analog of this to test the Bohr atom. Okay, so he's got one question is why that actually produces quantum. Thermal radiation to magnetic deflection. Walter Gerlach... expecting left or right movement. Walter Gerlach received his doctorate in physics at the University of Tübingen, 1912. His research dealt with blackbody radiation and the photoelectric effect. While serving in the military during World War I, Gerlach worked with Wilhelm Wien on the development of wireless telegraphy. That is the radio. After a brief interlude in industry, Gerlach obtained an appointment in 1920 in Frankfurt as an assistant in the Institute of Experimental Physics adjacent to Born's Institute. Gerlach's interest in molecular beams went back to 1912. Impressed by Dornier's observation of fluorescence from a sodium beam, Gerlach had tried to observe emission from beams from a few different materials without success. At Frankfurt, he wanted to investigate whether bismuth atoms would show the same strong diamagnetic exhibited by bismuth crystal. So diamagnetism means pushed across. His plan was to deflect a beam of bismuth atoms in a strong inhomogeneous electric field in order to design a magnetic field with the highest practical gradient. He undertook experiments to test various geometrical configuration. Born doubted that the deflection experiments would prove worthwhile. Galactic's response was to quote his favourite saying later, apt for the SGE as well. No experiment is so dumb that it should not be tried. Isn't that beautiful? Quandaries about space quantization. In 1912, the most advanced quantum theory was still the Bohr model, as generalized for the hydrogen atom by 1916 by Arnold Sommerfeld, and independently by Peter Debye. Their proposed quantization condition implied that Bohr's quasi-planetary electron orbits should assume only certain discrete spatial orientations with respect to an external field. They were disappointed that invoking space quantization failed to elucidate the vexing problem of anomalous Zeeman effect, the complex splitting patterns of spectral lines in magnetic fields. Although the normal Zeeman effect, much less common than the anomalous case, appeared consistent with space quantization, it was equally well accounted for by classical model proposed in 1897 by Hendricks Lorentz. This spread bafflement and glooming amongst atomic theorists, as described by Wolfgang Pauli. The anomalous type was hardly understandable, and since very general assumptions concerning the electron using classical theory as well as quantum theory always led to the same triplet. A colleague who met me strolling rather aimlessly in the beautiful streets of Copenhagen said to me in a friendly manner, "You look very unhappy," whereupon I answered directly, "How can one look happy when thinking about the anomalous Zeeman effect?" Pauli, as well as Stern, also made efforts to refine the theory of ferromagnetism advanced by 1913 by Pierre Weiss. That theory, still useful today, envisioned magnetic domains with a metal. However, it implied the average magnetic moment of an atom in a fully magnetized sample of iron was much smaller than the Bohr magneton moment of mu equals E on 2 mch, h bar on 2 pi, which is the Bohr moment, by a factor of 5. In an attempt to account for the difference, Pauli invoked quantization. In 1920, by carrying out statistical average over projection quantum numbers, he concluded the net effect of atomic moment should indeed be much smaller than the Bohr magnetron. Pauli's basic model was wrong, as it considered only orbital magnetism. Spin, undiscovered to 1920, has a major role in both ferromagnetism and the anomalous Zeeman effect. Nevertheless, Pauli appealed to space quantization of atomic magnets, helped by his colleagues, including Stern, mindful of the idea. For Stern, the immediate stimulus for SGE was a property implied by space quantization of the Bohr model that had not been observed. The model appeared to require that a gas of hydrogenic atoms would be magnetically birefringent, because the electron would orbit in a plane perpendicular to the field direction. Stern recalled the birefringence question was raised in a seminar. The next morning he woke up early, but it was too cold to get out of bed, so he lay there thinking and had an idea for the experiment. He recognised that, according to Bohr model, the space quantization should only be twofold, as the projection of the orbital angular momentum is limited to h plus or minus h bar on 2 pi. Although the Bohr, amongst other, had become uneasy about his model, how his model excluded the zero value. The twofold character made feasible a decisive test of spatial quantization by magnetic deflection of an atomic beam. Despite the smearing effect of the velocity distribution, in a strong enough field gradient, two oppositely oriented components should be deflected outside the width of the original beam. Classical mechanics, in contrast, predicted the atomic magnets would process in the field but remain randomly oriented. so the deflection would only broaden but not split the beam. Thus, Stern thought he had a prospect of an experiment that, if successful, would decide unequivocally between quantum mechanics and classical views. Isn't that beautiful? And that's the true thing, that if it's a classical magnet. But he still, I don't know whether he thought this was the spin of the electron, reading through here. From Gundakan to Duncan. So Gundakan means thought experiment to actual experiment. After hatching his idea in a warm bed, Stern hastened to Bourne. He met with a cool reception in his autobiography. Bourne said, "It took me quite a time before I took the idea seriously. I thought always the space quantization would be kind of symbolic expression of something which you couldn't understand. But to take it literally, as Stern did, this was his own idea. I tried to persuade Stern that there was no sense in it, but they told me that it was worth a try." Happily, Stern found an eager retreat in Gerlach, who until then had not heard of space quantization. Despite Stern's careful design and feasibility calculation, the experiment took more than a year to accomplish. In the final form of the apparatus, a beam of silver atoms produced by effusion of metallic vapor in an oven heated to 1,000 degrees was collimated by narrow slits 30 micron wide and traversed by a deflecting beam magnet 3.5 centimeters long and a field about 0.1 Tesla and a gradient of 10 Teslas per centimeter. The splitting of the silver beam achieved is only 0.2 millimeters. Accordingly, the misalignment of the collimating slit and the magnet by more than 0.1 millimeter was enough to spoil the experimental run. The experimental operating time was usually a few hours between breakdowns of the apparatus. Thus, only a meager film of silver atoms, too thin to be visible to the unaided eye, was deposited on the collector pack. Stern described in an early episode. After venting to release the vacuum, Gerlach removed the detector flange. He could see no trace of the silver atom beams had landed on the flange. Handed it to me. With Gerlach looking over my shoulder, I peered closely at the plate. We were surprised to see gradually emerge the trace of the beam. Finally, realized what had happened. I was then the equivalent of an assistant professor. My salary was too low to afford good cigars, so I smoked bad cigars. These had a lot of sulfur in them, so my breath on the plate turned the silver into silver sulfide. It was jet black and easily visible. It was a thing. It was like developing a photographic film. It's that beautiful. Oh no! Get back onto this. After the episode, Stern and Gerlach began using photographic development process. Although both continued puffing cigars in the lab, still recalcitrant difficulties persisted. As inconclusive efforts continued for months, Stern's assessment of space quantization wavered between conviction and rejection. Gerlach also encountered doubtful colleagues, including Debye, who said, "But surely you don't believe that spatial orientation of atoms is something physically real, that is only a time... It's only on the timetable of electrons." Another handicap was the financial disarray that began to beset Germany. Bourne was unstinting in his effort to raise funds in support of SGE, but he took advantage of the great interest in Einstein and relativity theory by presenting a series of public lectures in the biggest lecture hall of the university and charged an entrance fee. The money thus earned helped us for some months. But the inflation got worse. New means had to be found. Bourne mentioned the situation jokingly to a friend who was departing on a trip to New York. He was incredulous when, a few weeks later, a postcard arrived simply saying that he should write to Henry Goldman and giving him the address. At first, it took as another joke, but on reflection, I decided I must attempt and should be made. A nice letter was composed and dispatched, and soon the most charming reply arrived in a check for some hundreds of dollars. After Goldman's check had saved our experiments, the work on Stern Gerlach experiment went on successfully. Goldman, a founder and investment firm of Goldman Sachs and propaganda of Woolworth Co. stores, had his family roots in Frankfurt. Meanwhile, Stern had moved to the University of Rostock as a professor of theoretical physics. In early 1922, he and Galak met in Göttingen to review the situation and decided to give in. However, a railroad strike delayed Galak's return to Frankfurt, giving him a day long to go over the detail again. He decided to continue, improve the alignment, and soon achieved a clear splitting of the two beams. Stern recalled that his own surprise and excitement were overwhelming when he received a telegram from Galak with a terse message, "Bohr is right after all." Galak also sent a postcard to Bohr with a congratulatory message showing the photograph and clearly resolved splitting. Okay. After further experimental refinements and careful analysis, Galak and Stern were able to determine with an accuracy of about 10% that the magnetic moment of silver atom was indeed one Bohr magneton. This direct demonstration of spatial quantization was immediately accepted and was among the most compelling evidence for quantum theory. Yet, the discovery of it was double-edged. Einstein and Paul Ehrenfest, amongst others, struggled to understand how the atomic magnets could take up definite preordained orientations in the field. Because the interaction energy of the atoms in the field differs with their orientation, it remained a mystery how splitting could occur when the atoms entered the field with random orientations. Their density in the beam was so low that collisions did not occur to exchange energy. Likewise, the lack of magnetic birefringence became a more insistent puzzle. Galak came to Rostock later in 1912 and tried in vain to observe in sodium vapor. Similar efforts by others had the same outcome. Those and other puzzles, such as the normal Zeeman effect, could not clear up until several years later after the development of quantum mechanics and inclusion of electron spin in the theory. Those advances made Bohr model obsolete, but enhanced the scope and significance of space quantization. The gratifying agreement of the Stern galactic splitting with the old theory proved to be a lucky coincidence. The orbital angular momentum of a silver atom is actually zero, not h on 2 pi as presumed by the Bohr model. The magnetic moment is solely to half a unit of spin angular momentum, which accounts for the two-fold splitting. The magnetic moment, nonetheless, is very nearly one Bohr magneton by the virtue of the Thomas factor of 2, not recognised till 1926. Nature was duplicitous in an uncanny way. So, I wonder what the Thomas factor. A curious historical puzzle remains. In the view of the interests of the SDA in 1922, we would expect that the postulation of electron spin in 1925 should very soon have led to a reinterpretation of the SDA splitting as due to spin. However, the earliest attribution of the splitting to spin that we could found was not until 1927 by Ronald Fraser, noted that the ground state of orbital angular momentum was associated with magnetic fields of silver. Hydrogen and atom are zero. Practically all current textbooks describe the Stern galactic splitting as a demonstration of electron spin without pointing out that the interpreted experiments had no idea it was spin that they had discovered. Yet another cigar. The late Edwin Land, who told the cigar story many years ago, immediately responded, "I don't believe it." Therefore, for Frankfurt dedication 2012, we erected the 80-year-old experiment. The original SDE and beam deposited on the collector plate comprised only about a monolayer of atoms, roughly 10 to 16 atoms per centimetre. By heating a wire in a vacuum, we evaporated a complete amount of silver onto three glass slides. Then one of us, Frederick, in the role of Galak, vented the chamber with dry nitrogen, removed the slides, masked the portions of them with the shape of the magnet piece, pole pieces. Meanwhile, the other, Hirschblatt, in the role of Stern, had been puffing on a cheap cigar to prepare the tainted breath. One slide was exposed at short range to sulphurous breath, the second to two puffs of smoke, the third only to laboratory air a few metres distance. We looked for the contrast and masked and unmasked portions of the slides. In accord with Lance's skepticism, merely exhaling sulphurous breath on a slide, even vigorously, turned out to have no discernible effect. But exposure to cigar smoke quickly blackened the regions and the outside of the mask within a few seconds to a few minutes, depending on whether the dose of smoke was profuse or mild. We think it's likely that Stern did have a cigar in hand and baptized the detector plate with smoke. Wislak was busy venting the apparatus to remove the plate without his typical cigar. In fact, the smoke did the trick. Rather than the bad breath, it might have been missed 40 years later in the telling of the hearing of the cigar story. The reenactment inspired us to try silver-coated silicon wave and other deposition detector for molecular beams using an optical microscope, backed with a charge-coupled device camera to read the images. In the work carried out with Du Soo Chung, Professor of Chemistry at Seoul University, Korea, and Sunil Theth, the undergraduate student at Harvard University, we found that the setup proved a simple means to detect beams monolayer intensity with a spatial resolution of a few micron. The detector is not limited to sulfur compounds. It responds well to hydrogen, bromine and other halogens as well. It's likely to work well for many molecules that react with silver. Abiding legacy amid bitter ashes. In 1922, Stern became Professor of Physics and Chemistry at the University of Hamburg. He undertook an ambitious program to develop molecular beam methods. His program included major tests of several fundamental aspects of quantum mechanics. His crowning achievement, in collaboration with Emanuel Assmann and Otto Frisch, was the discovery of the anomalous moments of a proton and deuteron in 1933. There you go. That is, that these shouldn't have magnetic moments. That discovery astounded theorists and had a profound impact on nuclear physics. It revealed that the proton and neutrons were not elementary particles but must have internal structures. These experiments were far more difficult than the original SDE because the magnetic moments of the nuclei are thousands of times smaller than for electrons. Moreover, Eastman describes that the work had to be done with the sword of Nazism hanging over our heads. Stern and his colleagues soon had to immigrate. Stern came to the US but never regained a pace-setting role in research. The role passed to I.I. Ravi, who had become imbued with molecular beams and postdoctoral fellow in Hamburg. Galact, and I worked on molecular beams. Galact, his reputation enhanced by SDE, also did further enterprising research. However, after studying magnetic deflection of bismuth and several other metals, he did not continue to use molecular beams. Rather, he pursued a major series of experiments to eradicate the mysterious effects of the radiometer effect. Already in 1923, he and his student, Alice Gloschen, had made the first accurate measurement of radiation pressure. In according with classical theory, the results showed that pressure was proportional to the light intensity and independent of the wavelength. Much of his later research, well, it should be dependent on the wavelength, shouldn't it? Much of his later research dealt with chemical analysis, ferromagnetism, and material science. In 1925, Galact returned to Tubingen as a professor of experimental physics. There he inherited the chair that had been left by his mentor Friedrich Paschen Lines. 4 years later, Galact moved to Munich as successor Wilhelm Wien and continued there to his retirement in 1957. During the Third Reich, Galact steadfastly resisted the fanatics who attacked Einstein and its Jewish science. He never joined the Nazi Party, yet in 1944 he did become head of German nuclear research program. At the end of the war, Galact and among the 10 leading German scientists detained at the farm hall by the Allied forces. When the news came of the nuclear bomb dropped on Hiroshima, Galact behaved like a routed general, apparently suffered a nervous breakdown of sorts. Some colleagues even feared he was contemplating suicide. Later, he contributed much to rebuilding German science and campaigned to ban nuclear weapons. Stern became a US citizen in 1937 during World War II, served as a consultant to the War Department. Since renamed in 1945, he retired and settled in Berkeley, California. He often travelled to Europe, but never revisited Germany and refused to collect a pension due him, especially in this way, abomination of Nazism. He kept in touch with some German friends and during the post-war trauma sent them care packages. Stern and Galak met again only once in Zurich in early 1916. In an obituary written for Stern a few years later, Galak emphasised, "Whoever knew Stern appreciated his open-mindedness and unconditional reliability." Then Galak closed with, "At his farewell from Frankfurt, I gave him, in memory of the months of hopeless striving to see quantization, an ashtray with the inscription. This ashtray endured all those years till Berkeley, but experimental apparatus, books and originals and other results had burned during the Second World War, like so much else, reduced to ashes." We are grateful to Horst Schmidt Boring and Helmut Rienberg for helpful information, to Dudu Chung and Snell Suth for undertaking a project that involves gas smoke and silver mirrors, at the US Department of Energy and Petroleum Research Fund for financial support. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.